We did do chapter 12, verses 1 to 2. It seems to me that's all we managed to accomplish in chapter 12. We had a great discussion on two verses. So, Bill, I think this is a long passage to read. Verses 3 to 11. Would you read that, please?
And I'm reading from the Free Bible version. Think about Jesus, who endured such hostility from sinful people, so you don't grow tired and become discouraged. Your resistance so far hasn't cost you blood as you fight against sin. Have you forgotten God's appeal to you? When he reasons with you as his children, he says, "My child, don't treat the Lord's discipline lightly. And don't give up when he corrects you either. The Lord disciplines everyone he loves, and he punishes everyone he welcomes as his child. Be patient as you experience God's discipline because he's treating you as his children. What child doesn't experience a father's discipline? If you are not disciplined, which everyone has experienced, then you are illegitimate and not true children. For if we respected our earthly fathers who disciplined us, shouldn't we even more be subject to the discipline of our spiritual father, which leads to life? They disciplined us for a short while as they thought appropriate, but God does so for our benefit in order that we can share in his holy character. When it happens, all discipline seems painful and not something to be happy about, but later on, it produces peace in those who have been trained in this way, so that they do what is good and right."
Not something to be happy about is translated by the Common English Bible. No discipline is fun while it lasts.
And it seems to me there's whether we liked or thought our parents were right in all of it, it does seem that we generally do, we're built in to respect elders. I mean, I think that ebbs and flows depending on the culture. Mm-hmm. But in a family unit that isn't overly dysfunctional, there's a boundedness to discipline within a family unit or at school. You know, the discipline of study, the discipline of having to do piano lessons or whatever, musical instruments, singing. These are what we call disciplines. Well, it's not punishment, although he's talking about some punishment here. Mm-hmm. But if we're looking at training a child in the way they should go to bring in Proverbs, I think it is, that requires discipline.
Of course, in Hebrews day, parents disciplined the rod. Generally. In our day, we tend to try to talk it through. And we employ other kinds of penalties, such as timeout, removal of privileges, things like that.
Well, he almost gives room for that in verse 10. They disciplined us for a short while as they thought appropriate. Doesn't mean they were good and right about it. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean that we're necessarily way better off, although we do have child
security. My version says as it seemed best to them.
And so that doesn't approve of the methods, but it does say the idea that we respected them for putting boundaries and disciplining us, how much more in that comparison the discipline of God, that we would respect him. I guess that's where I'm tying it. It isn't.
Yeah. Well, sometimes God lets us suffer far more than our parents would ever do.
Are you saying he's not codependent and enabling of bad behavior? And our parents might be.
Yeah, I'm just saying that because of the great controversy, I think sometimes we don't suffer because we're being bad. But we suffer because we're caught up in that controversy. And God allows it for whatever good he plans to bring from it.
Let me,
and not all suffering is discipline.
That's true.
Clear. Yeah, and that's where I was going to go, Mark. As collateral damage, not all suffering is discipline. But there is a lot that we do that the consequences are not necessarily felt immediately or in the short term, but they can be very long, long distance from the behavior. And yet it's still, so it's lost as discipline, but it's maybe more natural punishment.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is it's not necessarily lost as discipline in the, so I was reading along in the Good News Bible here, which uses the word punishment rather than discipline. And I suspect that discipline is actually a better word, that this isn't recompense for bad deeds. It's a teaching moment. So the suffering that comes along, not because of what we have done, but basically what you call collateral damage, which is a good word for it, God can still use as a teaching moment.
Yeah.
And that actually encourages me that no matter what bad thing happens to me, God can turn it into something good, even for me.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was going, that even this isn't just about deserving something. It's about life and how it treats us. Because if you go back to verse 3, we start with Jesus, who couldn't possibly be guilty of anything. And he endured such opposition from sinners, and he had to resist to the point of shedding blood. So he underwent discipline and suffering, egregious suffering.
Yeah, that's a good point in terms of the context. And it begins, we have, of course, Hebrews 11 flows into Hebrews 12. And mm-hmm. I love just stepping back for that reason, since we are surrounded by such a great crowd of people giving evidence of their trust in God. And then going to Jesus, who begins and completes our trust in God, who never left the flow of relationship with his Father, endured the cross, disregarding its shame. So that wasn't his own doing. It was his own doing to become incarnate and to suffer the abuse of the collateral damage, I guess. Maybe that's one way of thinking about it. Is this where it was he learned obedience? Where is that?
That's somewhere earlier in chapter, I think it's chapter 6. It's where it says he was made perfect through suffering.
5, 8, and 9, maybe?
Chapter 5, 8, and 9. Yes, this is it. During his days on earth, Christ offered, in verse 7, prayers and requests with loud cries and tears as his sacrifices to the one who was able to save him from death. He was heard because of his godly devotion. Although he was a son, he learned obedience from what he suffered. After he had been made perfect, he became the source of salvation for everyone who obeys him.
And the Free Bible version, even though he was God's son, Jesus learned through suffering what obedience really means. When his experience was complete, he became the source of eternal salvation to everyone who does what he says.
That translation of becoming complete helps to do away with the idea that Jesus was in any way imperfect.
Well, and I would hope it helps us reframe perfectionism.
Yeah.
And so I look now, Hebrews 12 has Hebrews 11 really is the transition away from Jesus as the example of the interaction to Hebrews 11 being a crowd of people who've gone through the experience ahead of us, to now Hebrews 12 being personal. I mean, that's sort of how I see the flow. And now I'm going to have the life of Christ as my example, and I'm going to allow the work of maturity and completeness to come.
Which is going to mean suffering.
And so this, I have a philosophical conundrum. Is, I know in our experience, in the cosmic conflict, especially with rebellion against God, suffering exists. Was it required? Does that make sense? Did it have to go this route in order for people to become complete and mature?
So I will deepen that question a little bit more, because after the great controversy is resolved and sin has been completely unmasked as far as its consequences, we're led to believe that we're safe forever from the threat of sin. Now it's a known entity. Was it necessary for sin to enter in order to get us to that place? I would immediately say no, but it raises a lot of questions. If sin had not entered, how would this have come about? I'm sure God had a way, but it's not at all obvious what it is.
It's not something we've ever experienced. Consequently, we can't understand it. So consequently, we can't know what it is.
So I can accept that suffering is universal. Even the unfallen beings have suffered because of this cosmic conflict. And our suffering is different from their suffering. And we can learn. I guess that's the big thing. And that's the idea of our experiences being redeemed isn't, you know, us being redeemed, but it's everything, the good, the bad, and the ugly of our experience is redeemed, reframed in the great controversy story. That's one way I think I look at it.
I'm thinking on a very personal level about this. I'm comforted by chapter 5, assertion that Jesus didn't just passively say, well, this is my cross, I've got to carry it, and I'm going to just move forward and eat it. He cried to his Father relentlessly about it. And I'm sure he did it in a very selfless manner. I don't believe he was just saying, get me out of this. I don't think he was saying that. I think he was pleading for strength to bear it and emptying out his soul and his pain and his agony and all of that. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been praying with great cries, with loud cries and tears as his sacrifices to the one who was able to save him from death. So it's probably talking about the Garden of Gethsemane there, but I have to believe that Jesus, in all of his praying to his Father, which he did relentlessly, was always emptying out his pain to the only one who could understand what he was going through and why he was going through it. That comforts me, because I alternate between wrestling with God and, no, this is my cross, I'm just going to bear it.
Oh, I was just going to explore, I think, some of that, because I need to relate it to me as well and say everything culminated with the cross. But if Jesus is learning obedience through suffering, at 13, there's it seems to be in the narrative, a dawning of his future reality. Mm-hmm. And that, going back to the Father, to wrestle on that and not be, wow, I'm great, right? So there's a humility and emptying of himself continuously through. So it's so well practiced that when we get to the upper room, now the trial, if you will, of the garden is ahead of him, and he knows it's not going to be easy, but he takes up the basin and the towel of John 13, knowing, if I've recalled it correctly, knowing he came from the Father, was going back to the Father, and that all authority was his. He took up the basin and the towel. I mean, talk about discipline. And they didn't even see it at that time. as a teaching moment.
They were dumbfounded, though, I think, that he would do that, that he would stoop that low. They still were thinking about the kingdom. And to them, the kingdom meant glory and power. And so for him to pick up the basin and towel and say, you've seen me do this, now do it to one another, that's a pretty humbling moment for the disciples, it seems to me.
Peter, of all people, seems to have gotten that this was something really significant, because his first reaction was to refuse it. No, I'm not going there. And Jesus really made a point on it. Is if you're not willing to go here, you can't be one of my disciples.
And then do all of me. Well, no, that's not necessary.
Peter was still Peter, yeah.
Well, and the fact is, I think in getting a glimpse, each one has a different glimpse. And Peter, in thinking that way, not only is it typically Peter, I think when we look forward, and Jesus had to have seen it somewhat, is the whole baptism wasn't necessary because there's, in a sense, already been done. This is about something else that they need to understand. But Peter still saw his flaws, still saw that his mind needed to be cleansed. So to me, I can read into Peter that when it comes to the resurrection and Jesus being on the beach with the fish or whatever, and it's like he dunks himself into the water to go to the Savior, and he gets restored from his rejection. Anyway, I think the story is great, and Peter is a fascinating. John is still my favorite, but I love Peter too.
I want to also weigh in on the making this God's redemption of suffering personal. Because, you know, I have sometimes railed at, for those who don't know, I have an autistic son, and to watch somebody else, one's own suffering is one thing. Yeah, so watching somebody else's suffering that you can't do anything about is quite another. And, you know, I from time to time have words with God about this. The thing that always comes back to me is, yeah, Mark, I've suffered too. So that's the first thing, is that yeah, God suffers right along with me with this. But the other thing is that I sometimes hand the pen over to God in my journal, and God almost always ends when this is the subject, is, Mark, you don't understand it now, but you're going to love how this turns out. I'm going to make this into something beautiful. And, you know, God renews his promise to me that, yeah, despite the suffering, in the end, he will make all things right. Even my autistic son. This will be seen as an important thing in the great controversy, which is the only reason that I can see for God, you know, for God to allow suffering to continue, is that in order to avoid even more suffering later by sin's reoccurrence, we've got to let this one play out. But all of you who have had to go through it will be honored above your greatest imagination for having lent your experience to this task of making the universe safe from further suffering forever. And, you know, as I look at that, it's like, yeah, okay, if God's going to use it that way, I'm willing to wait.
Yeah, I think that we're back to chapter 12, verse 2. He endured the cross, ignoring the shame, for the sake of the joy that was laid out in front of him. I think we share, when we share in his suffering, we share in that joy. That something, he is going to bring something really cosmically wonderful out of it.
Can I add one other dimension that maybe we've touched on? Verse 3, Jesus, think about Jesus who endured such hostility from sinful people so you don't grow tired and become discouraged. Jesus at the cross, I mean, again, this could be seen throughout his entire ministry, that there were people who opposed him, and so forth, culminating that it wasn't the Father needing to have his mind changed to forgive those at the cross, but it was Jesus saying something for their benefit, and Jesus forgive them for they don't understand what they're doing, that the possibility of restoration existed under such duress, and that lives could still, and I think this goes to Mark, that lives can be changed through our response to suffering. And that for me is incredibly humbling, because I don't always respond well. Did that make sense? I don't know.
It is how we handle suffering that changes us.
Sometimes people look for meaning in their suffering, right? There has to be a reason for everything. And sometimes there just isn't. It's just evil. There's no explanation. There's no saying, oh, well, there's a silver cloud on that or whatever it is. That's why evil is so horrendous. Because
I look at the Holocaust that way. How do you look for a silver lining in the Holocaust? Well, there are beautiful stories that come out of it, of people who suffered with other people and carried them, helped them into the inferno that they went through to die. But I do think there was a reason God allowed the Holocaust. And it's what Katrina said, is so that we could see how evil we can be as human beings. Because up to the Holocaust, the world was increasingly thinking that, things are following the evolutionary model, things are going to get better and better and better, and we're going to become better and better, better people. You know, that we don't need atonement. We don't need anything to deal with our sins. You know, we can just evolve into perfect beings. And the Holocaust shattered that. It just completely shattered it.
I think one of the things that the end of time is going to show is the futility of anthropocentrism, mm-hmm. and reason, and how human beings on their own only cause ultimately more pain, more suffering, and that their way ultimately leads to either self-destruction, abuse, or some type of disempowerment, which is what people are feeling fairly strongly today.
Yeah. I think it does. It shows the futility of being without God on our own, just, you know, fighting our way through and thinking we're making everything better when in fact we're making things worse.
Of course, that's kind of the point of the whole great controversy, is that not just humans, but any being doesn't do well without that connection with God.
Yeah. I look at it kind of this way. 1 John 4:19 says that we love because he first loved us. That means to me that God is the source of love. That means we cannot create, generate, or even demonstrate love on our own. We have to be connected to the source of love. And without that source of love, we just mess up and hurt other people.
I think that's one of the reasons why it's so wrong when Adventists just focus on the law, is if the law is the answer to everything. If you just kept the law, then, you know, everything would be all right, as if that is the solution.
Yeah, and if the law is law of love, and we look at it as love, and we kind of get away from rule-based thinking, we can tie the two together, but that's not what we do with the law, unfortunately.
Well, and so it seems like to me that if God is love and is he's flowing this out towards us all the time. So he's love, he's freedom, he's forgiveness. It just permeates and flows from him. Mm-hmm. That acts by people like in the Holocaust or mass shootings or anything like this has been, at the very least, momentary, because it can be a momentary lapse of rejection of the flow of love, or it could be a systematic diminishing of love. I just think that there's the flow is calling us, God is calling us in all of that to listen to his voice without force, fear, intimidation, guilt, or shame. And then we have the examples, and sometimes I think maybe this is some of that, quotes, discipline, is the emergency measure of raising his voice, of allowing, maybe, I don't know if that's, of not shielding, of all sorts of things that get our attention. I don't know how best to describe it, because if I think God doesn't force, can he make us suffer, or is it far more consequence to actions? I get myself caught up in that.
Yeah. I tend to see it all as consequence of actions, but that without God ceasing to restrain things, God's in it because he's restraining it. And if he lets it go, we're in trouble.
Right. Well, that would be like the end of it, of everything. He lets it go to its full and natural consequence. Yeah. So he does restrain that. I can appreciate that.
I feel like without God in my life, I would be a total mess. But with God, I'm a partial mess. And then when he comes, I will be complete. And
what's messy gets burned up.
Well, then I'll be gone.
Well, if we live in the fire, in the everlasting fire, which Isaiah talks about, that's the fire that the draw. It's like it burns the dross, and that fire is the fire of love, as the way I see it. And it is love. Love, by the way, I think is a great discipline. Because when we really face the love of God for ourselves, it makes us painfully aware of our lack of love. And that awareness is humbling, and it brings us to where God can fill us with his love. Because our love is worthless, but his love is of inestimable value.
In the end, our love really is his love. Because we don't have any love without his.
Yeah. If we have any love, it's from him. Yeah. Anything else in this chapter? I'm relieved at verse 11. No discipline is fun while it lasts. It's not there to make us happy. That means, does that mean if I'm not happy, I'm being definitely disciplined? And if I am happy that I'm being disciplined, I'm now suffering something else that Jesus called persecution. Because Jesus said to rejoice with exceeding joy, for they persecuted this way the prophets which were before you.
Is there a difference between joy and happiness?
You know, for the joy that was laid out in front of him, he endured the cross. It didn't change the painfulness of the cross. I think you're right. I think there's a difference between joy and being, it's not fun. This isn't about being fun or pleasurable. This is about enduring something for something that is going to make you really happy someday.
I was just going to say, is the difference between the short-term joy and happiness and long-term joy and happiness. So yes. Well, it is even says here, you know, while it's going on, we don't like it, but later. So in the long run, it's the right thing to do, and it does lead to joy and happiness. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we need to stay in the moment, but also stay in context of it. And this is back to my thing that God's promise to me is, yeah, I'm going to make something out of this. In the long run, you will be glad you wound up going through this. But it's sometimes hard to keep the long term perspective in mind when the short term is kind of unpleasant.
Of course, it is the next few verses that give us encouragement.
Or tell us to get encouraged.
Of course, I want to hear what I cut off Katrine from saying.
Katrina?
I kind of forget a little bit, but I think I was going to say, you know, it's in the context of parents chastising their children and how, you know, little kids, like Mark said, you know, you can't see the big picture. It's something we all have to go through. We all have to be trained. And if we're not, I mean, I know when I was a little bit older, there was a philosophy of just let little kids run wild and do whatever they want to do. And just seeing the consequences of that, of parents who didn't give training or discipline to their children. They just used to run amok everywhere. It was just like, you know, that has consequences as well. And it doesn't ultimately lead to happiness for that person because they always think they can just do and get away with whatever they want in life. And ultimately they realize that they can't do that, that there does need to be order, there needs to be sacrifice, there needs to be towing the line on different things. When sometimes we're called to push against things and there's a right place for that, but I also think that sometimes children can hold resentments against their parents over particular issues, and they grow up with an inner anger or, you know, one day, yes, I live under your rules now, but once I get my own place, I'm going to do whatever I want to do. And it's amazing what the perspective of the maturity does, because once they do leave home, they find themselves doing or saying things that their parents did or said, right? Rather than living this life of rebellion. But of course, some children do choose that way to go. I'm going to rebel against everything you taught me because I hated you for forcing me to do this. And so there's a variety of responses to that chastisement. And, you know, we might all have been in some of those places hating our parents because they forced us to do things we didn't want, or following and then seeing the wisdom in it all and finally being grateful for it. So I don't know where I was going with that, but just some random thoughts.
One of the things that parenting brings out is that the parents, in disciplining their children, they discipline themselves, because very often the children are just copying parents' behavior. And what the parents see as bad in their children, they're really seeing themselves. So I think the discipline works both ways, with the children and with the parents. With God, we have a perfect parent. So he is not disciplining himself, but he does feel our pain that even he allows to happen with the discipline. And I saw something in trying to find, there was something that said, and it was in Hebrews, that Jesus suffered so that he, that, and I'm, this is poorly said because I can't find it, and it's not the exact wording, but it's something to the effect that he suffered so that he could feel our suffering. It's not said quite that way, but And I maintain that the reason Jesus had to come to full maturity and completeness with suffering is so that he became fully empathetic, so that he could feel what we feel.
Would it be fair to say so that we know that he's fully empathetic?
I want to say yes, and yet I want to say no, on the other hand, because there are some things that, by the laws of the universe, there are things we cannot understand until we suffer them. Now, I believe, backing up here and going your way, Bill, I believe that God has suffered everything we have suffered from eternity. And that Jesus' death on the cross was just a taste of that suffering that he had suffered. But I still think the depths of that suffering could only be met by becoming a human being and going through that. It wasn't complete until that point. So it's kind of both and.
I always wrestled when I was a teenager because I used to hear preachers say that all the time. You know, Jesus suffered everything, you know, a human being could go through. And I'd always get mad and I would think, he might have suffered as a man, but he never suffered as a woman. He never went through the sufferings that women go through. And so in a way, yes, Jesus can relate to me, but it was always a step removed in the sense that I didn't think he suffered or knew what it was.
I wasn't thinking in terms of quantity. I was thinking totally in terms of quality, of the depths of suffering, the ability. Because once you develop an empathy that can feel everybody's suffering, it doesn't matter whether it's male or female, you still feel it. Because you've gained that, I want to say skill, but it's not really a good term. You gain that depth of ability to feel what another person is going through.
I can appreciate that more than the sentiment of preachers saying Jesus went through every, you know.
That was a more perfectionistic kind of stance, I think, that you are hearing. I see it very differently than that, I think.
Of course, we don't want to suppose that God had to come down and become a human being in order to figure out what was going on with humans. I mean, God, I feel that God experiences with me intimately. God experiences it right along with me, everything that I feel. So the purpose of Jesus coming was not so that God could experience what it was like. He already had that. And I think that God experiences that with us, whether male or female. But to me, the experience of Jesus coming was for us to realize that, yeah, this isn't just a theoretical thing. God actually came down here and went through it himself, not so that he could figure it out, but so that we could know that he had figured it out. I don't know. Is that too fine a hair to split? Or
no, I think that's the primary purpose. I don't see God though as static in his empathy. I see him as developing deeper and deeper levels of empathy. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I certainly would agree with that because I feel that God is experiencing with me in the moment. It's not, you know, I knew from the very beginning Mark was going to go through this. It's like God is right here, right now, experiencing it with me, and sometimes experiencing it for me when I have to just shut down and back off. God is still there saying, okay, I'm here experiencing it with this with you right here, right now, in the moment.
Given that, God experiences everything with us. Every experience we go through changes us a little. does his empathy. And I'm not meaning change in the sense that God isn't good enough the way he is and he needs to be better. I'm not talking about change in that way. I'm talking about the way going through an experience deepens and enables connections and with people and relationships to go on a level they couldn't before. I don't know. I may be in depth too much.
I will offer. Oh, I was going to say, I will offer this up, the idea that if God is relational, so in my book, God is relational, it's not an if. And with that, he's open to the dynamics of that relationship. Therefore, there is a sense in which while God is infinite and knows everything, he's learning at the same time. I don't know if that makes sense.
Oh, process theology.
See, and I don't know that that is necessarily, I mean, I was just reading an essay and I need to go back to it, distinction between open relational theology and process theology, and that there are some differences, and I can't pretend to even have my head around them yet. But there is the idea that God is relational and is open. If not, would the great controversy have even happened?
Well, that's a good point, because God took a tremendous risk in allowing freedom and giving people high intelligence along with that freedom. I think of back in the 1930s, Hitler wanted to create a super generation of people who could be take orders but didn't have enough intelligence to rebel. God didn't do that. He did the opposite. He created power, powerful people, thinking people, people with high intelligence, and he allowed them freedom. Dangerous combination when you think about it. The dynamics of what happened as a result of human beings choosing to pervert their intelligence and Satan choosing to pervert his intelligence is going to lead to territory that has never experientially happened. It may happen in foresight. It may happen in God's perception, his mind, he may understand everything about that, but it has never happened in reality, in experience. And I think that's the basis on which, the reason I say this, because our static reality created a whole bunch of nonsense. For example, because we believed everything was static, like the Greeks, we decided our brains were machines that could only do so much. And if you lost something, it was permanent. You couldn't regain it. And if the machine broke down, tough. That was just the way it was. And if you decided to increase anything in the machine, no, it was just the way it was. And now we know that the brain is plastic and that intelligence can increase. Yes, it can decrease. Things can happen. We can actually work to repair things that happen. If God created a plastic brain that's dynamic, then his reality is dynamic. And I don't want to pursue that too far because I'm finite and I have no clue about an infinite being. And so I'm treading in dangerous waters when I go any further than that.
You made it sound far more intelligible than I think I did. So thank you.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
I wasn't trying to make it far more intelligible. I was just trying to grope my own way through this situation. But
I lost my connection there for a moment. So I don't know if maybe you've already talked about it, but yeah, I definitely agree with what you just said about the early church fathers importing the Greeks' ideas of a static God has caused most, if not all of, well, not all, but a large majority of the problems we have with our relationship with God, because God is very much, I think, the Hebrew God who was very much in the moment. He got angry, he got disappointed, got upset, and but the question that this raises for me, and this is like the edge of the diving board. After this, it gets deep and there's no bottom. But well, my personal conundrum here is that there seems to be, in my thinking, a difference between, well, one part of me says that God knows everything that is in such detail that there's no difference between what could be as God sees it and what is. Another part of me says, no, what is different than what could be. Even for God, who knows it, knows both paths in perfect detail. The path actually taken, as opposed to the path that could have been taken, is in fact a difference from God's point of view. And as I say, there's no bottom after you jump off that step. But that's the very edge of my thinking on this, is that, yeah, that there is a difference in the path we choose. And this comes back to freedom. There is a difference in the path we choose, even from God's point of view.
Yeah, I think we've come a long way from discipline. So I'm suggesting we move on to verses 12 to 17. Mark, would you read those verses, please?
So this is the Good News Bible. Lift up your tired hands, then, and strengthen your trembling knees. Keep walking on straight paths so that the lame foot may not be disabled, but instead healed. Try to be at peace with everyone and try to live a holy life, because no one will see God without it. Guard against turning back from the grace of God. Let no one become like a bitter plant that grows up and causes many troubles with its poison. Let no one become immoral or unspiritual like Esau, who for a single meal sold his rights as the older son. Afterward, you know, he wanted to receive his father's blessing, but he was turned back because he could not find a way to change what he had done, even though in tears he looked for it.
I like what you say, because it makes more sense. He couldn't change what he had done. My version says he couldn't find a way to change his heart and life.
The Bible also says, even though he tried really, he really tried and he cried hard, Esau couldn't change what he had done.
That makes more sense in the story itself. Well, the truth is, he couldn't change what he had done, especially by the laws of the ancient world. Once you made a transaction, that transaction was done. You couldn't go back and change it. You couldn't reverse it. But Jacob could do something about it. And he later, when he gets in contact with Esau, he refers to himself as, through his servants, he refers to himself as your servant Jacob to my master Esau. And in those words, he tries to undo what he did.
Can I ask the question, do your best to live in peace with everyone and look for holiness? If you don't have this, you won't see the Lord. And the good news, it really struck me that it sounds like works to see God, as opposed to maybe the disciplines of, I mean, I think as Pauline theology goes, there's a union of relationship and flow, output flow. Love is action. It's not static. So these things, in essence, if we were to go, I have faith, but I'm not going to let anything flow out of me. I'm not going to worry about my behavior and the damage it might do. So I can see both sides, but the initial reading and my knee-jerk reaction was, well, that sounds like a works religion.
Yeah, my version kind of makes it sound that way too. I think make straight paths for your feet, strengthen your drooping hands and weak knees. You know, you do it. You do it. Pursue the goal of peace along with everyone else and holiness as well, because no one will see the Lord without it. Make sure that no one misses out on God's grace. This reminds me of a child. My mother gave me a long list of things to do. and it does sound very works-oriented. And yet, if love is action, is it really works-oriented? Or is it relationship?
And I think that's where maturity, completeness, mm-hmm. sees it differently.
So you've heard of the purpose-driven life. Do you remember that?
Yeah,
I've heard Warren, of it. I think, yeah.
Yeah, the purpose-driven life and how he talks about some of the benefits of a purpose-driven life is it simplifies your life, it motivates your life, brings meaning to your life, and helps you avoid the zigzag effect, right? If I followed my own choices, and I'd say my life has been a bit of a zigzag, and I think that's God's doing. But for this purpose, let's think about it. When it says make straight paths for your feet, I feel it's like, you know, Pilgrim's Progress. It's stay on the path and don't wander off into the brambles or the hill of legality or, you know, whatever it is. Stay on that path. And if you do, right, it says, so what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather be healed. I have this colored in my Bible. I think I colored it in when I was in my early 20s because I saw in this verse, and it's very special to me, that the broken areas of my life, if I stay on God's path, they will be healed. And what is lame in me will be not dislocated, but it will be healed and it will be strengthened. And so it's like this beautiful invitation of Jesus saying to walk with me, walk on my path, so that I will ultimately work all these things out. I will fix them. I will heal them. So I see more of it as a promise rather than a command, and something that brought me a lot of hope. But I can appreciate as well the way, you know, you see it.
I think if, for me, if I put love in this whole thing, it ties everything together and makes it very relational, very dynamic, and very promise-oriented. You know, if I were to say, if I stay on the path of love and in relationship with God and let him love me and fill me with his love, then I'll make peace with everybody. I'll have great relationships with everyone. And we'll all be ready to see Jesus.
I want to affirm the idea of the promise from rather than seeing it as a works or driven in the context of Hebrews and what we've just seen. All of them have been given a promise. And mm-hmm. now he's speaking to the current audience about not giving up on God. And so to me, it's easy when I take it in isolation to think, oh, this is just going back to something oriented to performance. But I so appreciate hearing Katrina talk about how her experiences, this is promise. It's a reframing, which I need to keep hearing.
Isn't this admonition, I mean, isn't this straight out of the Sermon on the Mount? Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall see God.
Yeah, and notice that Jesus takes those admonitions and puts them in a promise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I see this, as Katrina was saying, I see this more as a promise than a command. Actually, that's not a bad way to look at the Ten Commandments also. They're promises.
Well, and that's actually something you can do with Hebrew. You will not do such and such, or you shall not do such and such. That's either a command or a promise, depending on how you look at it. And the Hebrew kal imperfect is just that kind of languaging. Going to be a promise or a command.
So I think it's the viewpoint that we were pretty much all raised with, that this is all about works and keeping the commandments, that makes us read these first and foremost in the context of, oh, this is a command, this is something I got to do in order to win God's favor. When if read just as it is, maybe it's not trying to say that at all. Maybe this is all on us.
Yeah, I'm sure that's why I read it that way initially. So it reminded me of my mother handing out the things I needed to do for the day.
So often we can confuse God with a giant parent, right?
Well, he kind of invites us to do that.
Yeah, the language definitely does. But once I moved outside of that, it was just so different. And, you know, I'll share something personal here. And my parents are good people. But when I was young, I remember saying, one day I'm going to get out of here and I'm never coming back. And I don't care if I end up in the gutter somewhere. And it was that determination that drove me, and combined with, you know, being a fearful young person but clinging to God, it was God that allowed me to make those huge leaps that I never would have been able to do if I just had this attitude, well, you know, I'll just stay home and take care of everyone. I know that sounds selfish, but I didn't confuse God with my parents. And that helped me to embrace, you might say, and be willing to throw everything aside in order to pursue God and who God was.
Thank you, Katrina. I did some of that while I was home. There were some things I just did not accept in my parents. But I think I was, some things were pounded into my head just a little so firmly that I never could quite erase that or make that leap completely. Though when I got on my own, when I left home for college, I did just about anything I wanted to. And I didn't do anything bad. I did the venture of some things like going to Berkeley for Berkeley Campus Ministries on Sabbath and things my mother would just be, oh, don't go, that's dangerous, you know. So I did make some drastic changes, but it was a long, harder process for me, I think, for me, Katrina, than for you. I had to have some hard knocks before I could mature enough to make those changes. So do you want to go on to verse 18? See if we can finish the chapter. We only have 20 minutes.
I was going to read from Romans to stir the pot, but it's okay.
Go ahead. Go ahead, because that we're coming to new material and it might be better to wait till next week.
Romans 9, starting verse 10, and not only this, but when Rebekah also had conceived by one man, even by our father Isaac, for the children not yet being born nor having done any good or evil, that the purpose of God according to election might stand, not of works, but of him who calls. It was said to her, the older shall serve the younger. As it is written, Jacob I have loved, but Esau I have hated.
Now, which of that is stirring the pot? The whole thing? I mean, I can see several things.
Certainly the thing that jumps out most at me is Esau, I hated. Wait a minute.
So it was the purpose of God according to election might stand, not of works, but of him who calls.
Which verse, chapter, verse?
Nine, chapter nine.
Nine, and that is verse 11. And here, verse 17, it says, for you know that afterward when he wanted to inherit the blessing, he was rejected. For he found no place for repentance, though he sought it diligently with tears.
Yeah, Free Bible renders Romans 9, starting with 11, but even before the children were born and before they had done anything right or wrong, so that God's purpose could continue, proving God's calling of people is not based on human performance. She was told, the older brother will serve the younger one. As scripture says, I chose Jacob but rejected Esau.
This is John Calvin's key text. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, well, quoting Malachi 1, 2 to 3. But yes, I understand what you're saying there, Mark, about John Calvin.
This is a great example of divine determinism. God puts leprosy in people's houses. God hardened Pharaoh's heart. It's all through the Bible. Jesus uses it. Every single book uses it, I think.
God hardened Pharaoh's heart. Pharaoh's heart was hardened.
Pharaoh hardened his own heart.
What is it?
Pharaoh hardened his own heart. Yeah, it says it three ways.
As I understand it, in the at least older parts of the Old Testament, pre-exile, there was only two operators. There was either humans or there was God. There was nothing else. And so God winds up taking a lot of the blame for things that just happened, or that Satan did, or other things, because in the understanding of the time, there was no other option. If I didn't do it, then God must have done it. And what this tells me here is that, yeah, that didn't go away even in the New Testament, that there was still this thinking of well, if I didn't do it, then God must have done it.
It seems like the underlying message that's coming through in both, or at least in the Romans text, is this was God's calling. God had called Jacob. And when it's like when somebody wins Miss America, it means that there's 99 other women who didn't win it. Or, you know, sorry, that's the wrong number. How many states are in America? Sorry, it's terrible. I should know that.
Anyway, one, we know that other people lost.
Yes, yes. When one person wins or one person is called, the other person misses out. So, you know, here were these two sons, and usually everyone assumes the older one has the priestly function. They get all the land and the house and the, you know, and the woman or whatever it is. And the younger one just has to deal with, you know, the scraps, or they have to figure out how they're going to make their living. And yet God turns things on its head. The very one that you expect to be the blessed one, the leader, right, the priestly guy who has a relationship with me, no, God is saying, no, I'm gonna reverse what you expect here. I'm gonna pick the one that you're not expecting. I'm calling the younger. And again, you have to say, well, yay, that's wonderful. And, you know, someone had to miss out in a way. You know, we're now thinking now, I say, well, God calls everybody, right? God can call all of us into this relationship with him. But for the purpose of the story, right, it's Jacob, right, who becomes that father figure, who has the sons, who, you know, the line that Jesus comes through, right? It was all about the line. And so thinking of the bigger context of the story here, yes, we have Esau, right, who for one morsel of food gave up everything, right, points us back to Adam in Genesis, right, Adam and Eve, who one morsel of food gave up everything. Like, wow, how could they have done that, right? But that's what happened. And so is there a moral to this story? Be careful of, you know, taking the bite out of that sandwich or whatever you're going to have for lunch. But spiritual things weigh heavily even in the small things of life. So don't throw away things of great value over common things.
Yeah, I think maybe we struggle between Paul's use of this example of God calling. It's a very clear example of God's calling. And it makes sense in the story itself. But then he takes us from that to the God has mercy on whomsoever he wants, but makes resistant whoever he wants to make resistant. And that raises the question of freedom. And I think that's why we struggle with this passage. But I would like to sit on verse 15. I will have mercy on whomever I choose to have mercy, and I will show compassion to whomever I choose to show compassion. Jesus makes it clear that God shows mercy on everyone. Makes the rain and sunshine to fall on each and every human being. What most parables do is create a limited window on the matter and make the equation that Paul is really trying to establish here in Romans. That it is not, and as he says it, so then it doesn't depend on a person's desire or effort. It depends entirely on God. That's the point he's trying to make. And he used very divine deterministic language to convey it. But that divine deterministic language is all through the Bible. And this is an example where I can accept his story to make that point that it's not God. I mean, that it's not us, but God who makes the difference. It's not we who earn our salvation. It's God who gives it to us. I can go that route and take that story to it. But when it comes to making someone resistant and making someone accepting, I have to say this is human language. This is not inspired language. This is human language to make a point. And that point lies behind the language rather than with the language being the last word. And so that language to me is, or the point behind the language is he calls anyone who will choose. But his calling creates resistance. And so some people resist because they were called. And that's how I've dealt with God hardening Pharaoh's heart. Pharaoh would never have hardened his heart if God hadn't sent him all the evidences of the truth. Once you send someone evidence, they have to choose. And they're going to choose one way or another, depending on, as Paul puts it, the pots for wrath. There's two kinds of people. There's people who open up and accept God's call, and there's people who resist it. So he still makes people that he knows in the end are going to resist. Just as he makes those who know who are in the end are going to who accept the call. So I have to get behind the language and work this out. And I'm so glad that Ellen makes it very clear that the words are not inspired. It is the human beings who are inspired and the thoughts that are inspired. But the language, sometimes we have to work around or behind that language to make the point clear.
Isn't there an inherent selfishness and judgmentalism in? So this works fine as long as I'm looking for God's message to me. The place it gets me in trouble, though, is if I start applying it to somebody else. So if I say, okay, God has called me and foreordained that I should follow him, and that's well and good. But the moment I say, well, this person's not following God, therefore God must not have called them, now I'm in trouble. And it's because I have switched the focus from God's one-on-one with me to, okay, what's this mean about somebody? It reminds me of you know, after Jesus made up with Peter, you know, he says, well, what about this guy, you know? So Jesus, I think, as I recall, Jesus has told him that he may be asked to follow him to a martyr's death. And Peter says, well, what about John, you know? And Jesus kind of says, that's none of your business. And I think maybe that's what applies here, is that God has called me. What God has done with somebody else is none of my business.
I think the most gracious way we can say about someone who hasn't accepted the call is they haven't yet accepted the call. Maybe they need to hear
it yet, right?
They need more time. Maybe they need more evidence.
And what does it look like, right? So if the idea that God is calling everyone, we don't know where, we only know where we started mm-hmm. in that journey. We don't know where another person has started in that journey and where they have grown, where I have grown. And we are always looking at some externals as the evidence, but we don't know what's on the heart and if they're hardening their hearts or if their hearts are being softened. I guess that's where I would go with that and say, I just have to keep saying, Lord, I want my heart soft and use me to, in ways that at the very best would help soften somebody else's heart and not harden them or myself.
I think it's interesting that as Adventists, we do all of this with the concept of the remnant. But we are the called ones. Therefore, anyone who is not a Seventh-day Adventist is not called, is not chosen, is not part of the saved, right? We do this as a denomination. And it goes right back to that great disappointment and that being passed out of other churches and the humiliation and the embarrassment and then the pointing of the finger, well, you must be Babylon then. And you know, we create these boundaries, but we've created our own story of we are the called and chosen. And if you're not part of us, then you're not on the boat. You're not part of the saved. But I love what you've all said about this idea of not having these hard lines about the other, right? And allowing other people to be called as well, and part of God's ultimate plan, that it's not just us, it's not just me. There are others who are part of it, right? And we don't have the final judgment on that.
Shall we stop with that? Time is pretty much gone. And I would like to close with prayer. Let's pray. Dear God, we've looked at many things this morning. Discipline, how Jesus suffered, what that suffering means for us. God's calling and what that means for us and for others. We ask that you will guide us continually on this path that we are on, that we will continue to look to you in every way as we journey, that we may keep you in our vision and in our sights, in trust and confidence that you are leading us home. We thank you for this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.